We get things rolling this afternoon by getting on board the G&M Family Market phone line and welcoming in a talented author who has written a number of books, including Superman, a terrific read, Satchel, I love that so much, Rising from the Rails, and Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry Tye joins us. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
And also, I should mention, too, a season ticket holder at Fenway Park, near enough to be able to watch our boss, Stephen King.
Absolutely. Yes. Watch him put on his rally cap. And the only person I've ever seen not just bring a book to every ball game, but read it.
That's absolutely in keeping with the pattern. There's no doubt about that. Well, we want to talk. We're looking back throughout the spring and summer in 1968 and wanted to talk with you about Bobby Kennedy and not just what happened in 1968, but the evolution of Bobby Kennedy that you wrote so eloquently about in your book. Let's start with the word liberal. There was a time when that was not a pejorative term here in America.
There was a time when that wasn't a pejorative term, and there was a time where that adjective didn't describe Bobby Kennedy. The young Bobby Kennedy, when he was starting out just after law school, went to work for the table-thumping, red-hunting Senator Joseph McCarthy, which is not exactly a place we would have expected to see our liberal icon Bobby Kennedy.
No, but that experience transformed him in many ways. How did that help him begin his path to becoming a liberal icon?
So it was, on the one hand, his maiden voyage in terms of the whole world of politics, and he got to see how people worked with the press and manipulated public opinion to turn it around on an issue that they were passionate about. And Joe McCarthy was certainly passionate about the issue of looking for communists behind every pillar at the State Department. And with Bobby Kennedy, he had an experience with McCarthy. He came away liking Joe McCarthy, despising McCarthy's young protege named Roy Cohn, who went on 40 years later to be Donald Trump's tutor. And Bobby, as he did in everything in life, started out knowing very little and ended up coming away learning from what he had been through. And the McCarthy experience helped him get launched in politics, but also helped him come to see that he was more liberal than conservative.
Well, he had a very interesting disposition as the runt of the litter. You point out that his brother Jack often referred to him as Black Robert, and a lot of people you spoke with talked about good Bobby and bad Bobby.
Yes, so Bobby Kennedy's father, the guy who really controlled the whole Kennedy family, was the patriarch Joseph P. Kennedy. And Joe Kennedy had zero expectations for his middle son, Bobby. As you mentioned, he referred to him as the runt of the litter. That was partly a reflection on his size. He was the smallest of the Kennedy boys, but it was also a reflection on the fact that he seemed like the one least likely to succeed. And over time, Joe came to see that Bobby, in fact, was most like him and was the most likely among all of his children, and he had nine of them, to get things done.
He also carried hate around, and his dad had said, when he hates you completely and then forever, and that maybe manifested itself in no greater way than his relationship with Jimmy Hoffa. What fueled that hatred of Hoffa?
So I'd like to say, actually, Joe Kennedy said brilliantly, and this was meant when he said it as a compliment, he said, "Bobby hates like me," and that was something that Joe thought that people should be passionate about things and know who they liked and who they hated. And Bobby Kennedy, in his life, hated four people. And you might say that he had not bad judgment looking back from a historical perspective. One of them was the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover. A second one was the guy we talked about a minute ago, Roy Cohn, Joe McCarthy's arrogant young protege. The third one was Lyndon Johnson, who seemed like he was from a different planet than Bobby Kennedy. He had come from a poor environment in East Texas, and Bobby was the Silver Spoon Harvard guy. But maybe out of all of them, the one that Bobby hated the most was the very powerful head of the Teamsters Union, the biggest and most powerful union in America, and that was Jimmy Hoffa. And Jimmy Hoffa, like the other three that I mentioned, had grown up without all the opportunities that Bobby had had. And he was a really hardened and in lots of ways a crude guy, but an incredibly effective advocate for his Teamsters. And Bobby hated him because Hoffa was probably corrupt. He hated him because Hoffa sort of flaunted every rule out there, and he hated him because Bobby was narrow-minded enough at that point that he couldn't understand why Teamsters members, in spite of all those other things, or maybe because of them, saw Hoffa as their great champion against the very powerful trucking companies and other companies across America.
The book is so incredibly well-researched and unearthed so many details. I love the scenario that you talk about, the meeting with Hoffa and Bobby Kennedy, when Kennedy actually got on the phone with Ethel and said, "Yeah, I'm leaving." I think he says, "You know, unless I blow up, unless the place blows up before I leave."
Exactly. So that was a wonderful, and he was only partly joking when he told Ethel that. He said, "If you hear a loud noise, you'll know there's a problem." That meeting also, if you believe the two of them and their stories that they told afterwards, they wanted to each show how manly they were. They actually got down on the floor and had an Indian wrestle one another. And each of them claimed to have won, so we're not quite sure what happened.
We're talking with Larry Tye, author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. What fueled Bobby Kennedy's decision to run for the United States Senate?
So he had, if he had in his life any epiphany moment, it was that moment in November of 1963 when he was just getting out of the swimming pool at his great estate called Hickory Hill outside of Washington, and the phone rang, and it was the poolside hotline to the White House. And on the other end of the phone was J. Edgar Hoover. And as soon as Bobby heard that it was Hoover on the phone, he knew it was going to be bad news. The bad news, as we now know, was his brother having been shot and soon to die in Dallas. And that basically had Bobby not quite sure what to do in life. He went through a period of deep depression that lasted months. He thought about just giving everything up and going off and using his father's money and traveling with his growing family in Europe, or maybe going and teaching at a university. And those were interesting thoughts, but nobody who was named Kennedy and who had been trained by Joe Kennedy was ever really going to give up public life. Bobby decided, as the ultimate carpetbagger, that the best state to run for an office from was New York. There happened to be a vulnerable Republican in New York, an affable white-haired guy named Ken Keating. Bobby Kennedy went to New York, campaigned across the state with his mother, Rose, telling New Yorkers that he, in fact, was really a New Yorker and not a Bay Stater from Massachusetts, and convinced enough people that he won as a U.S. senator.
And even then, he was not a natural campaigner. It did not come easy for him. And even at the time of the 68 campaign, what was it that allowed him over time, certainly by 1968, to begin to make those connections with the people that felt so connected to him?
So it was an extraordinary thing. As much as Jack Kennedy had drawn big crowds, Bobby, the press started referring to him as the fifth Beatle. People would tug at his clothes, tug at his hair. He would often come from a campaign appearance with one shoe and one cufflink and a tuft of hair missing. And I think what, as you say, and you're exactly right, it was not his eloquence, because he was not naturally eloquent. He had a bit of a stutter. He was nervous in front of crowds. But I think what it was something that we never expect to see or hear from a politician, whether it was 50 years ago or today, and that is a politician who's not just telling the truth, but telling people the hard truth, the truth that they don't want to hear. So what that meant in 1968 was going into black groups and white groups and telling them exactly the opposite of what they wanted to hear. He would tell black audiences, what we need is, number one, safe streets. And the only time we're going to talk about racial justice is if we stop the riots and get safe streets. And he went into white audiences and he said, number one, what we need is racial justice. And the only way we're going to get that is if we have safe streets. And he went into both groups, told them things that they weren't used to hearing pandering politicians talk about. And people were so struck by this guy. So were journalists. You know, the most cynical and hardened of all audiences are the journalists who were listening to him. And they started out hating him, and they ended up falling in love with him.
In 1968, the big change came, I believe it was in March, when Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not seek the Democratic Party nomination after a strong showing by Gene McCarthy in New Hampshire. What made Kennedy enter the race as opposed to relying on McCarthy to be the anti-war candidate?
So when Bobby Kennedy saw Gene McCarthy doing well in New Hampshire, he had actually made the decision to jump into New Hampshire before the primary, but he wanted to give McCarthy, who had been there in the cold, snowy hills in New Hampshire, an open shot at LBJ in that one primary. But Bobby was chomping at the bit to run for president. He realized that all these young anti-war activists who had come to him and asked him to run, that they were his natural constituency. He hated the idea that if there was going to be a Catholic candidate, that it be a guy named McCarthy rather than Kennedy was anathema to Bobby, that these young students would find another hero was anathema to Bobby. And finally, he decided that much as the idea of challenging his brother's vice president initially seemed like just the wrong move to him, in the end, he decided that he had no choice but to do it, and he did it passionately. He did it late enough that a famous columnist named Murray Kempton sent a telegram to Ted Kennedy, because Bobby was jumping in just after McCarthy had seemingly showed how vulnerable LBJ was. And the telegram read, "St. Patrick didn't drive all the snakes out of Ireland."
You mentioned he was not a particularly eloquent speaker, but he found his passion and he found his compassion seemingly at around the same time. Was there a moment that spoke to that passion and his connection to people that resonated any better than in Indianapolis in April of 1968 when he broke the news of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.?
So there was no moment that was better. And to remind your listeners, what happened then was Bobby had been out campaigning in his first contested primary in the state of Indiana. He had been out on an airplane, the family airplane called the Caroline, named after Jack Kennedy's daughter Caroline. He flies in that afternoon to the airport in Indianapolis, and he's greeted by the young mayor of Indianapolis named Richard Lugar. Lugar says to Bobby, "I've got horrible news. Martin Luther King was shot and killed today in Memphis." And Lugar continues by saying, "You are due to talk tonight in the Black Ghetto in Indianapolis. You will not give your speech, because if you go in there, you might not come out alive, or there might be a riot." And Bobby listened and proceeded to ignore the advice, drove into the black community, jumped up on the back of a flatbed pickup truck, and for the next 5 minutes gave an ad-libbed, the most eloquent and pitch-perfect speech that I've ever heard a politician anywhere in any era give. He went in there to embrace that community for the loss of Martin Luther King, and instead the community embraced him for the loss 5 years earlier of Jack Kennedy. That was Indianapolis that night was just about the only major city in America with a substantial African-American community not to have a riot, and the reason was Robert Francis Kennedy.
In early June, the night that he was shot, he had just won the California primary. As you look back at things and the way the campaign and the race were developing, do you feel like that victory in California would have catapulted him to at least the Democratic nomination?
So I'm glad you asked, and I think there's no doubt. I think a couple things were going to happen. Bobby's famous last words before he went into the kitchen that night and was shot by Sirhan Sirhan, his last words on the podium were, "And it's on to Chicago, let's win there." And what he meant, everybody thought that he meant, "It's on to Chicago that summer for the Democratic Convention." What he really meant, it had a double meaning. He meant that, but he also meant, "And it's on tomorrow to see Richard Daley in a secret meeting with the all-powerful mayor of Chicago." Daley, according to his son tells me 50 years later, that his father was planning that next morning to endorse Bobby Kennedy for president. Had Daley done that, the only real opponent after the California victory that was left and that Bobby was worried about was Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who had not entered any of the early primaries. Had Daley kicked off the wave, I think, of endorsements that would have followed his by big, powerful politicians, of mayors of big cities and governors, I think it would have been impossible for Humphrey to win the nomination. Bobby would have been the nominee in Chicago. the way Democrats work back then, the way both parties work back then, is the top two candidates united to form a ticket. And I think the ticket in 68 would have been Kennedy, Humphrey. I think that had you had no riots in Chicago, had you had Bobby Kennedy, who 8 years before had run his brother Jack's successful campaign against Nixon and knew every one of Nixon's quirks and vulnerabilities, had you had a ticket like that, I think that they would have trounced Richard Nixon. But you don't have to believe what I think. Richard Nixon was convinced that Bobby was going to be the nominee, and Richard Nixon was as worried as he could be because he knew that every dirty trick and hardball tactic that he, Nixon, had learned in 60 from Bobby Kennedy.
That was such a traumatic year, as some would say the most turbulent in the 20th century, at the very least. What did the assassination of Bobby Kennedy do to the American psyche?
So it did a couple things, and very concrete things. Imagine, I can't imagine a more different figure that could have been in the White House as opposed to having had Richard Nixon there for 6 years or however long he lasted, than having Bobby Kennedy there. It gave America, having lost Jack Kennedy, then Martin Luther King, then Bobby Kennedy, many liberals and many young people who were engaged in the process, I think, lost hope in 1968. They lost hope. They lost the chance of having Bobby Kennedy. They lost a sense that issues like racial injustice and poverty and the war in Vietnam, instead of being at the top of the agenda and really having given those a shot at redressing, we ended up staying in Vietnam 2 or 3 years longer than we had to. We ended up having issues simmer for 50 years, and we see what the result is today in terms of racial tension. We ended up with poverty, where Bobby Kennedy would have made that his number one agenda item. The psyche of America and the factual on-the-ground reality in America, I think, couldn't have been more different and couldn't have been more changed by one event than by the assassination that night exactly 50 years ago.
50 years have gone by, and in that time, while Jack Kennedy is still revered, at least some of the shine may have come off his legend as we've learned more about him. But it seems to me that 5 decades later have made Bobby Kennedy's star shine even brighter because of what we didn't know, and that's what he could have done if given that opportunity.
You're exactly right, that Bobby Kennedy had no shot to show us what he could have done, so it was all a question of hope. He also had no chance to disappoint us. Jack Kennedy gave us 3 years of a partly successful presidency. Bobby Kennedy left us with a sense, in my mind at least, of always seeing that young guy, 42 years old, tousled, windblown hair, buck teeth, and enormous possibility, and now we'll never know.
Larry Tye is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me on.